Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello, great to be back. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell. Joining me this week, hello and welcome back to Michael Cox, absent last week, back with us today. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. I actually thought last week's pod was the best of these podcasts for a while, which was a bit worrying from my perspective, but really enjoyed learning about the newly promoted teams. Obviously, I don't watch anywhere near as much championship football as you do. It was a good primer for me ahead of the start of the campaign.
Fantastically humble as ever. Really enjoyed doing that. Liam Tharm's debut, very impressive. Head back and listen to that ep after this one if you haven't already. It's also a welcome back to returning guest, the big ticket. John Muller joins us from the States. Hi, John. How's it going?
It's going great. Good to be back.
Good to have you. We've got such a brilliant show for you guys today. First, we're going to look at the extinction of long ball football in the Premier League, led by Michael, and then in part two with John, we will introduce the Athletic's 18 player roles at the result of John's latest big piece. We'll get kicked off with Michael's work titled, "With Burnley Gone, Is Long Ball Football Dead in the Premier League?" Yes, Michael, as it turns out. What prompted this piece?
Yeah, just skip to part two of the podcast. You've answered the question there, Ali. What prompted the piece? You've answered that as well. Burnley's relegation. It's something that I think we all saw coming. I mean, Burnley were a big outlier in the Premier League for probably most of the time they were in the Premier League. But I think particularly for the past two or three seasons, when some of the other sides who played, even if you take it away from long ball football, sides who played defensively were no longer defensive. Sides who were quite unambitious became more ambitious. I think Brighton is the obvious example. I think Crystal Palace moving on from Hodgson to Vieira is another example. And Burnley was still there playing roughly the same kind of football. And I didn't think there was ever really a sense they were even trying to evolve. I know they brought in someone like Maxwell Cornet, but they played him almost like trying to get on the end of flick-ons and knockdowns rather than what he'd done previously, which was be a interesting creative player. So yeah, the fact that they were no longer in the Premier League, I wanted to kind of highlight that. And as part of it, I wanted to have a look at the data and see whether my assumption, and I guess most people's assumptions, that they were the last side standing in that respect was true.
John helped you out with the data for the piece, so he's well placed to discuss this as well. I will just note that, and I'm sure you will have seen this, despite not watching as much Championship football as you should, one of the big stories of the first 2 weeks of the Championship season has been Burnley's insane evolution under Vincent Kompany and the way that they are playing. If you look at essentially build-up type metrics, they are only second to Swansea City, who are about as extreme and dogmatic as you can get in terms of heavy, slow possession. They are just behind them so far, only 2 weeks in, but it's been incredible to watch this team playing in Burnley football shirts, but not necessarily playing the way that we associate with Burnley. And I think the fans, it's almost the best thing that could have happened for them, I think, with Dyche having left, having suffered relegation, to big moments in the modern history of the club after such a good spell together. I think it's actually breathed new life into the fan base, and it's good to watch. I would recommend that people watch the next Burnley game. I think there's one on Friday night against Watford. I think it'd be helpful for you to just explain how you collectively decided on how you were going to define the phrase long ball for the purpose of this piece.
Yeah, well, I opened up FB Ref and I opened up Excel, and then I decided it was better to just open up Slack and message John and say, John, can you do some stats work for me? And he provided far more categories of relevant statistic than I thought would be available. I think there was about 10, 11 here that includes everything from kind of average pass distance in a side's own half to percentages of passes that are backwards to share of passes with the head, which I think was actually quite an interesting one and quite telling. Mm. And John also sorted the sides. And this is data going back. I think originally the document was about 15 or so seasons. John originally broke down the sides into three types, using all of those categories that he provided, which I suppose is maybe slightly similar to what we're going to talk about later. I actually only used two of the categories in the end. So I use goalkeeper's vertical pass distance, and by vertical we mean how far it goes forward. Mm-hmm. And the same thing for centre-backs. And the cutoffs I ended up using were 40 metres for the goalkeeper and 7 metres for the centre-back. And seven sounds quite low, but that's the average. Obviously, a lot of passes are going sideways, some passes are going backwards. So 7 metres forward in the 19 of the 20 Premier League sides last season, their average passing distance from the centre-back was under 7 metres. And then finally, my very simple methodology was, or my very simple categorisation was, that if you ticked both boxes, if your centre-backs were generally passing more than 7 metres forward and your goalkeeper was passing more than 40 metres forward, you were a long ball team. If you didn't tick either box, you were building up from the back. And if you ticked either box, you were kind of mixed. A much more simplified way of doing what John did originally with his groupings. But I just wanted to do things that were quite easily imaginable for people reading the piece. 40 metres from goalkeeper, 7 metres from a centre-back. I think it's just quite easy to get into your head. And when you looked at the teams, it was pretty much the ones who I expected to be in those categories.
Yeah, and I think that your simple categorization didn't really disagree that much with, you know, using all 11 or 12 of these stats, which tend to be highly correlated with one another. I think that when teams play direct a lot, you know, they're not making a lot of back passes in their own third. They are playing a high share of passes over 40 yards, whatever. All these things tend to relate to one another. But, you know, when you asked me originally which teams played route one or which teams played direct or long ball, I don't remember exactly which terminology you used. It wasn't immediately obvious to me what that meant. And I think that there are different ways that we can define what it means to be a direct team or a long ball team or a route one team that might show up in different ways in the data. So I do think that there's a big advantage to just saying, look, here's my simple metric, here's the cutoff, and now we can think clearly about like why this did or didn't apply to some teams. And I think you had some interesting discussion of that in the article.
Just in terms of last season's Premier League campaign, 17 of the 20 teams that took part in last season's Premier League were inside your playing out from the back category, as you've explained it. Burnley were in the long ball category, and then two teams in the mixed category, Crystal Palace and Everton, but quite happily, Michael, for the two different reasons that they could be in that category.
Yeah, that was quite a nice little detail. Yeah, Everton were in the mixed category because while their centre-backs kept their passing relatively short, Jordan Pickford just launches it forward, which I think is very easy to... He's got a particular way of doing it, hasn't he? He really winds himself up for those long kicks. And the other exception were Crystal Palace, which was a bit of a surprise because, as I mentioned earlier, Vieira has made Palace a lot more, I suppose, cultured on the ball, a lot more patient. And from Hodgson to Vieira, the distance that the goalkeepers pass the ball forward has dropped significantly. But their centre-backs actually pass it forward, directly forward, quite a lot. And I think particularly Anderson. And actually having done that article, watched him play against Arsenal on that opening game, and he was constantly pinging diagonals. So maybe that is one... that's one flaw with doing it the simplified way I did. You know, his diagonal passing, I don't think you would really say were long balls. They were long passes rather than long balls. But yeah, by simplifying it, you did end up with that maybe slight anomaly.
With Burnley now relegated, the obvious conclusion is that long passing, long ball build-up, if you will, as a primary method of building up, has vanished from the Premier League. But as you wrote this before opening weekend, was there anything from opening weekend in the Premier League that flew in the face of that, Michael or John? Any unexpectedly long ball teams from an admittedly tiny sample size?
Well, Erik ten Hag accused Brighton of playing long ball, which was interesting. And, you know, I think Brighton's second goal, where they build a move from their own corner flag and eventually Pascal Gross scores, shows they weren't. But actually, when you look at some of the data, they played 100% of their goal kicks long, which I'm fairly sure I haven't checked, but I'm fairly sure they wouldn't have done that many times last season. So perhaps they were just trying to evade that press. And I think it's also worth pointing out that the two titled contenders from last season have brought in more traditional strikers. So I think they have the option maybe of going long a little bit more if they want to than last season. But of course, yeah, neither Manchester City nor Liverpool would even vaguely show up as being, you know, close to a long ball team in the data categories I used.
John, particularly with a whole build-up philosophy going extinct, at least for the time being, it, of course we have to drill deeper to sort of define what we consider direct play. You touched on it there, in order to better differentiate between playing styles. I wonder if the more interesting and relevant question off the back of this about style of play now looks more closely at moments in transition and how teams handle that moment, by which I mean which teams look to attack quickly as soon as they gain possession of the ball, or which prefer to recycle, hold on to it. I wonder if that might be a more interesting thing to look at in the modern Premier League.
Yeah, I think that situational data is always more interesting. What phase of play teams are trying to do certain things rather than overall averages, which can kind of muddy those differences. One thing that I liked about Michael's use of goalkeeper passes and center back passes was that it does kind of distinguish between when and how teams are choosing to go long. He has a chart in there of what I think is one of the major data stories of the last decade, not just in the Premier League, but across Europe, which is that goalkeepers' passes are getting shorter. And I like that both because it's a clear trend in league after league and because it's such a like clearly intentional thing like that. Mm-hmm. If a manager can do nothing else, he can at least persuade his goalkeeper whether he's going to play short or play long. And after that, you know, maybe other things take over. And, you know, maybe you're Brighton and you're being pressed by Manchester United and you choose to play over the press rather than to try to play through it as you might normally want to do. But goalkeeper passing is very intentional. And we've seen that at Crystal Palace, right? Vieira came in, he asked his goalkeeper to play short, and they did. But after that, the center backs are still playing long. And, you know, is that intentional? Are they baiting the press and then trying to play over it? Are they trying to build from the back, discovering that they're just not very effective at it, and then the center backs are having to play long? And I think that those are separate and interesting tactical questions.
Michael, would it be fair to say that the glory years of long ball football, just looking at the last decade, were between 2012 and 2016? You know, just sifting through your piece, in 2012-13, there were two teams that fit into the long ball category who finished in the top half of the Premier League. In 13-14, Tony Pulis won Manager of the Year. As discussed previously on this pod, the last manager to win Manager of the Year without winning the Premier League. So there was clearly no issue with this style of play, or even rather that it was particularly unusual at that point. At 14-15, you described as the archetypal Premier League long ball season, with Warnock, Allardyce, Pulis and Dyche involved in it. And we culminate in 15-16, what I'm calling the glory years, in the most direct title winners of this era in Leicester City, in the mixed category, I should say, not a long ball team. But 10 of the 20, half of the Premier League teams being or fitting into the long ball category, only four playing out from the back. The glory years.
Yeah, which I suppose is quite weird to talk about now, because back in 15-16, if we were to say, you know, this is the glory years of long ball football, you'd be saying, what are you talking about? Everyone's playing technical possession football. But yeah, in hindsight, it was. And it's really those managers who come up again and again. I mean, this is just the last 10 years of data, but Pulis is in charge of three teams. Pardew's at two teams, Allardyce is at four teams. It is the same managers coming up again and again. And you have to say, probably managers you'd be confident we wouldn't see again in the top flight. I think until, you know, 2-3 years ago, you wouldn't be surprised to see, well, Allardyce did come in as an emergency kind of firefighter manager. But is anyone going to go for Allardyce or Pulis or Pardew now? I think probably not. I think Dyche maybe.
And let's just touch on Leicester's tactics in winning the title in 15-16. I mean, you can't get away from the fact that it was a season in which the majority of what we call the Big Six underperformed. But also, in terms of their style of play under Ranieri, if this was a league with 10 long ball teams out of 20 and only four, the strongest teams, you'd say, in the division, theoretically at least, playing out from the back, their system, their style, Michael, seemingly was just perfect for the season in which it was taking place, if that makes sense. both against the, you know, in terms of handling the long ball teams who they needed to tuck away, to put away in order to pick up a lot of points, and then against the larger teams as well to play in a slightly different way.
I hadn't considered that point about defending against long ball teams. That is interesting. Yeah, I think Wes Morgan and Robert Huth is clearly the most aerial-based centre-back partnership you'll ever see challenging for the Premier League title. So that is interesting. Hadn't considered that at all. And yeah, in terms of what they were doing on the ball, they were mixed because their goalkeeper was going long. Kasper Schmeichel was averaging 50 vertical metres forward with his passing. The centre-back's a little bit shorter than average. That, in fact, quite a lot shorter than average that season. But yeah, it was the goalkeeper playing long that put the mix. There was no real intention of playing out from the back from Schmeichel.
Presumably mostly targeting Okazaki rather than Vardy.
Yeah, felt must like have he... been. Yeah, wouldn't have been going right to Mahrez, would he? Left to all Brighton, maybe. But yeah, I guess Okazaki.
John, Brighton, as ever, are an interesting case off the back of this. They went from a long ball team in this categorisation under Chris Hughton to very much not that under Graham Potter. And if you cast your mind back to the summer of 2019 when that happened, the sacking of Chris Hughton was met with some disapproval, I would say, in general. But that was in the middle of this big shift, a league-wide shift, where long ball teams were dwindling. And in hindsight, you have to look back and applaud the leadership at Brighton for basically getting in front of what could have become a bigger problem for them within the year or two.
Yeah, I think so. There are a couple things that are interesting to me about that kind of revolution under Potter. One is that it's so rare. I think Michael pointed out that by his metrics, this was the only time that we saw a team go directly from a long ball style to a clearly playing out of the back team rather than going through the mix zone or getting relegated and coming back up. You know, it's just very difficult to change a team style overnight. Not just by telling your goalkeeper to pass short, but by, you know, having an effective buildup behind that. And it's also not clear that this was, you know, a priori a great idea to go from a long ball style directly to a short buildup. The piece doesn't necessarily dig into this too much, but I think it's worth talking about why this evolution is happening. Like, why are teams suddenly not playing out of the back, and is it necessarily a good idea? Is it an evolution or is it just a trend? Is it a fashion? And will we see it swing back just because fashions change? For example, we had Norwich last season was a new school team, right? They were very intentionally like trying to play short and they were just horrible at it and probably would have been much more effective if they had played Chris Hughton long ball. And so it's not clear to me that following this fashion is good for everyone.
We're going to get on to questions of that nature in a second, but out of the, you know, the big six, Michael, no surprises that for the most part they are all play out teams and have been over the last decade. But Chelsea, Liverpool and Man City all had one season out of the last 10 where they weren't considered, by your definition, a short passing, a playing out from the back team. Which managers were involved there who were trying to go against the status quo of big Premier League clubs? And did they have any success?
Well, for Chelsea and Man City, it was two of the years where they actually won the league. Chelsea under Mourinho was the last Mourinho title. And Manchester City under Pellegrini. So that was quite interesting. The Liverpool season was the season where they went from Rodgers to Klopp. So it was a bit of a transition season. And my expectation would be probably that because Klopp, when he came in, was really focusing on pressing and getting that right first and foremost, there wasn't that much focus on training, on building up well from the back, and they basically just went long and kind of came back to that at a later date. But that's just a suspicion.
And one name cropped up a few times, which surprised me, albeit could be from a point of ignorance. That's Ronald Koeman.
Yeah, it did. It was the only one that surprised me, really. I think everyone else is pretty much what you'd expect. But yeah, Southampton surprisingly pop up there, having not been there under Pochettino. And then Everton, when Koeman moves to Everton, he goes there again. I think that's maybe, in fact, it's almost certainly a bit of a limitation in the way that I've used data. Indeed, if you use John's more complex or his methodology that takes in more categories, then Everton are defined as kind of middle rather than being old school. But yeah, it is interesting. I mean, clearly the goalkeeper was playing long. The centre-backs were playing long. Koeman himself was maybe the most notable centre-back of the 1990s who played very long passes from the team, so maybe that's relevant to how he wants his teams to play.
I'm always wary on this podcast as much as any other of the phrase that often gets pulled out, which is correlation does not equal causation. And I'm sort of treading the boundary here. But after reading your piece, Michael, one of the things that I was thinking about was that it seemed to me from your takeaways that there was a period in the Premier League where the regular long ball managers tended to overachieve, or at least achieve, in the short term, but that now that edge, as it was, if it was, seems to have completely gone. The teams in the last few seasons who have played long ball football have not achieved or overachieved. Would you agree with that statement?
I think so. I think the answer to that is probably very complex, but the managers who ended up in the Premier League with long ball football were the best at doing that style of football, if that makes sense. There were presumably lots of long ball managers who were still in the Championship and still in League One, etc. And yeah, they did get to a certain point, but we didn't really see many teams at all near the top of the league who were playing that style of football. So there were limitations. That probably isn't answering your question, but it's a fair question to ask.
I have a question that both of you guys are better positioned than me to answer, which is this evolution that seems teleological in the Premier League, this like trend toward a better kind of football that's playing out of the back, playing short, hasn't really happened in the Championship, where long ball football is still fairly pervasive. Why is that? And, you know, should more Championship teams be trying to play short out of the back?
I think if you looked at the evolution of the teams who have won promotion from the Championship, you would see that apart from Neil Warnock's Cardiff City, they all do fit into broadly a playing out from the back category and have broadly moved with the trend that's happened at the top level, albeit in the Championship, I would say confidently that it normally takes between 1 and 3 years for the trend to sort of drip down. So it may just be that it's a little bit slower to happen. And for sure, it's less pervasive. There are 24 teams in the Championship, and there wouldn't be nearly as big a proportion of teams playing out from the back as there are now. I don't think I have any answers for it. That's why I prefer to ask the questions. And Michael, any thoughts from you?
No, but it does seem to be a kind of generational thing, doesn't it? I can't think of many young managers these days who are kind of known for playing direct football, or many young managers who are known for anything other than quite effective passing football. And I think, you know, there's maybe a question about what the motivation of some managers is. In the sense that I think Allardyce, to a certain extent, and Pulis and Warnock accepted that they were never going to be in charge of a big club, an Arsenal or Tottenham. And I don't think you're ever going to get one of those jobs if you play like Dyche's Burnley. It's for me, it's almost like the managers are quite careerist. And someone like Brendan Rodgers, I think, is a really good example. Or even Pochettino, actually, is a really good example of someone who became known for his style at Southampton rather than the success. And actually Ronald Koeman, who followed him, took them to a higher position in the league, but was not really being linked with Tottenham and those kind of jobs, although did end up at Barcelona, which was quite odd. It really is about managerial philosophy and about managers' age and background and I think where they want to go.
And no doubt influences as well. I think... And I know next to nothing about the development of coaches and the education of coaches, but I dare say that that has had its own shift broadly in line with what we're talking about, and I'm sure that all plays into it. What about the future? In tactics, up to this point anyway, I think I'm right in saying that most trends have had counter trends and things can move in cycles, which is great for us because we have to talk tactics each week, and if we just had the same every time, things would be quite dull. What chance do you think that as a response to this, it may become a viable option for success to go long again, maybe in a different way, maybe it looks a little bit different, but become effective again at Premier League level?
Potentially. I must say, I think there's been a real cultural change in terms of what players and what fans expect from their football. And while I think you can construct an argument to say, hey, if all centre-backs are going to be just, you know, quite slight ball players, why don't we target them with long balls in the air? But I just can't really see where the managers will come from who will play that football. And I can't see where the players will come from who want to play in a team like that. I think to a certain extent, there has just been a change. I think football is now viewed as much as an entertainment as it is a sport. The fact that you said Burnley fans are really enjoying the new style of football, I think it's quite interesting. So, yeah, maybe I'll be proved wrong and maybe there will be a bit of a return to long ball football. But I personally can't really see it. I think there might be one or two teams that get promotion and become anomalies in the Premier League, but I can't see a widespread return. I think some things are cyclical in football tactics, but I think gradually the game has just become more and more technical over a period of decades, and I can't really see it going back to route one.
I think maybe we've kind of already lived through that cycle, and if there was a moment for long ball football to come back, we're past it. It seems like, you know, we're a good 10 years now into this progress from long ball football to teams that really are very intentional about building out of the back. And we've already seen a reaction in the middle part of the last decade where teams pressed very intensely in league after league as a reaction to this kind of increased build-up play. And I think that the broad story is that the build-up won out. Teams sort of doubled down on press resistance, on structured positional play in the build-up. They beat back presses, and we're kind of now at a place where teams aren't pressing as much as they used to. Kind of softer 4-4-2 mid blocks are much more popular than they were, and build ups are still very slow, kind of from top to bottom across the league. And so, if you were going to try to play long balls as kind of a counter trend to what was going on, it might have been a lot more effective a few years ago than it is right now with teams sitting off a little bit more defensively.
I think that's an excellent point, Michael. You mentioned the entertainment factor, football being considered perhaps more so than ever something to be entertaining, and this style of football playing into that. But I wonder if it's bad for neutrals, bad for those watching football for entertainment purposes. I don't necessarily believe that shorter passing should equal entertainment. And I suppose where I'm coming from more specifically is, if everyone's doing it, then there's very little tactical variety. Therefore, matches look broadly similar, or you can be pretty confident of how a match is going to look. I personally, and it is always personal preference, that to me isn't hugely entertaining or particularly exciting.
I basically agree. And I'd kind of go back to what John mentioned briefly, that Norwich were trying to play possession football last season and doing it quite badly. And I just don't think offered much to the league, really. I would rather have retained Burnley than Norwich because they did offer some variety. And it's, I don't particularly want to be watching long ball football every week. But the interesting thing to me in any sport, or the most interesting thing, is often when you get a complete clash of styles and you've got two teams or two competitors trying to do completely different things. And the fun thing when you watch Manchester City, for example, go away to Burnley, and I know they thrash Burnley 5-0 at home pretty much every year, but away to Burnley, they had more problems, was because they had to do both. They had to cover both bases. On one hand, they would usually play slightly more physical players. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they did things like they play Ake left back or something like that to give them more height in the air. But actually, they became more Manchester City. They almost automatically have more possession than usual. They try to keep possession because they don't want it to end up in a Burnley game. They don't want a back and forth game. They do press higher, or they do press intensely, because actually, if you press them playing the first ball out of defence in open play, they can't really play that style of football. So actually, the sides become more extreme. So yeah, it was interesting. I enjoyed watching Burnley at times last season. I thought it was interesting that they only won one of their first 25 games or something like that. And it was actually against Brentford, who I would have had down as the team in the Premier League who were maybe most set up to deal with the way that Burnley played. Mm-hmm. In the end, that wasn't the case. But yeah, I will slightly miss Burnley's long ball football. And if Burnley come back, then it's not going to be with the same style of football. So we'll have to cross our fingers that maybe Sean Dyche will come back, I guess.
One of our colleagues, Dave, a Watford fan, made the point when we were discussing this before recording that as a Watford fan, the best moments in their history have all come from being really good at playing long ball football. And I imagine that Dave equates those moments to excitement and entertainment. So I do think it's a really interesting one. I don't think that every fan cares enough about the percentages or about the analytical reasoning behind this shift of style of play. And I dare say there might be some that will miss it. Anyway, this is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We're moving on next. Stay with us for part two, where we will be introducing the Athletic's 18 player roles, including orchestrator, safety, unlocker. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hi, I'm Danny Kelly. You can join me, Jack Pitt-Brook, and the rest of The Athletic's frankly tremendous team of Tottenham writers twice a week throughout the new season for the View from the Lane podcast. It's the podcast that gives you everything you need to know about Spurs, as well as all the joy and pain of actually following them. Search for The View from the Lane everywhere you get your podcasts and listen ad-free on The Athletic.
Right then, John has been busy. John, a piece went live this morning. It's been a popular piece on The Athletic site today, that's fair to say. In broad terms, you have tried to achieve a more detailed way to describe footballers' tactical roles than the traditional position-based categorization. I had a lot of fun reading this morning. I bet you had quite a lot of fun putting it together as well.
You know what? I didn't. It was miserable. I'm not lying to you. And it was miserable because it's really hard. Like if you thought that defining team styles, even something as simple as like long ball play with data was hard, which it is, defining a player's tactical role in data is so much harder, and teasing those things out took a lot of work, a lot of trial and error, a lot of late nights and banging my head against the wall. But it was also really interesting, and I hope that comes across in the end product.
I'm immediately quite sad because I think I'm right in saying that your career change and your arrival at The Athletic came, you know, this came from a position of passion. This was a passion project, right? alongside a very different career, and you've changed and now you're doing what you love and you're not enjoying it. It's hurting you. And, you know, maybe there's a lesson in there. Maybe there's a lesson in there.
It's a kind of masochistic exercise where I love being hurting myself.
Well, as everyone knows, not every striker plays in the same way and does the same things within the role of striker, within the position of striker. And not every fullback plays in the same way either, nor do they have the same tactical instructions. Every player has different habits and traits. And this is the sort of thing that you were drilling down into. Now, you explained the method very well in the piece, and I don't think it is necessary for us to go deep into the method, but dare I say it, if there are people listening to this who are interested in analytical thinking, in models, and in how they get put together, they should definitely go and read the method. It was really interesting to see how you approached it. On a very basic level, if you'll allow me to try and explain, you took the type and location of every touch players in the big five European leagues have made since, I think, 2017-18, did some data wizardry using StatsBomb data via FBref, and ended up, John, with 18 player roles across six broader positions. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think one important caveat here is that this is built on the stats that are publicly available on FBref, which are available primarily at the season level. At least those were the stats that I used. So what we're working with here are aggregate stats and aggregate stats at the season level. That already makes it a little bit difficult to do players' tactical roles, which can change, you know, from phase of play to phase of play, from part of the game to part of the game, from game to game, week to week, month to month. When you're looking at high-level season overviews, you get kind of a very general picture of what that player's tactical role is. And that can be useful for some things, and it can also be challenging.
Michael, it's a similar theme to some of the podcasts that we did last season, perhaps the season before. We're so old now on this pod. The Glossary podcast, you know, we were trying to be more specific about player roles than traditional terms. John's attempted a similar thing, but done it with a different method using cold, hard facts and data.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the, if you take deep midfielder, for example, I think, you know, as a box-to-box distributor, which is, I guess, kind of deep line playmaker, and a builder, which maybe we'd call that the Makalele role or something like that. Yeah, it's great. I just really like looking at it. And I think it's almost a slightly underrated thing, or something I haven't seen anyone comment on, is that it's a pie chart. I mean, it's not 18 equal sections. You know, there's more anchors than there are spreaders. There's more finishes than there are targets. It's also a pie chart. It's just brilliant to look at. I love the color scheme as well. I think a really great article. I realize I'm talking about a color scheme on a chart, which is not great for podcasting. So it's worth looking at the actual graphic on the site, on The Athletic, or on John's Twitter feed as well. Because it's, yeah, just lovely to look at.
Well, the smile on John's face, I think, has made all the hard work worth it after that kindness from Michael Cox there. John, is the idea that this will be used going forward by Athletic writers to be more accurate when speaking about player roles for the teams that they cover?
I think there are two objectives here that are maybe related, maybe independent of one another. The first is to kind of lay the groundwork for some future data work. There are a lot of ways that it can be very useful to have groups of players in similar roles when you're doing data work, both to give you an initial idea of what that player's general job is, which, you know, a lot of the data requests that we get in The Athletic are, hey, my team is linked to this player in a league that I don't watch and I don't know anything about him. What kind of player is he? You know, where would he fit in this team? How would he change the way that we play? And player roles are kind of an initial start down that road. They can also give you a better baseline for comparing, you know, one player's expected assist to another. If one is supposed to be defending more, playing deeper or wider, it's going to affect the opportunities they have to record stats. So there are lots of like nerd reasons, but maybe kind of like a more philosophical rather than data nerd reason is to think a little bit harder about what we mean when we talk about player roles, and to think about, you know, do the roles that we use mean what we think they mean? Do we have a clear definition of them? Would my definition match someone else's? Would the player that I describe as a deep-lying playmaker agree with, Cox's definitions? And how would that show up, if at all, in kind of the things that we can measure?
I mean, you've brought it up, so I'll pick up on it. In the piece, for each of the 18 roles, you suggested three examples of players that fit into those roles as per your work. Now, inevitably, we've seen one or two or more people who have looked at the graphic, possibly not read the full piece, maybe they have, seen a player's name in a role that they don't necessarily agree with or see themselves and say, well, I don't agree with that, so this must be a waste of time, which I imagine must be a blow. We've also got those that say essentially, leave it out, John. We've already got player roles. We all know what they mean. Sweeper, playmaker, box-to-box, holding midfielder, fullback, wingback, false nine, winger, and the other ones that Football Manager have produced. That may be true if you want to be general and keep things simple, but you wanted to add a little more depth here.
Yeah, and you know, I get the objection about we have player roles that we understand, and why would we add different kinds of player roles? And I think the first answer to that is that we're adding different kinds of player roles all the time. You know, we're always talking about a new type that, you know, has become trendy, or just we've arrived at a better definition of what this role is. But the roles that we use, A, are vague. B, they're overlapping. You know, a holding midfielder can absolutely, I think, also be a deep lying playmaker. Maybe he can be a sweeper. Maybe he can be a box to box guy. Maybe there are kind of traits that define one role that are orthogonal, that are not related to the traits that define another role. So if you have a guy who's good at headers in the air and a guy who's also good at, you know, long passes, which is he? Is he a guy whose role is to, you know, contest aerials, or is he a guy whose role is to play long passes? And using data to define these things forced me to confront those kind of questions and to try to separate out, you know, the qualities that really separate one group of players from another rather than the ones that stand out to us.
John, one interesting thing I thought about the article, and I was interested to know your kind of thinking and how this might have changed when you went through the project. The start of the article says, positions are a terrible way to think and talk about football. But obviously the center of the chart are the positions. And I wondered whether you at any point in the process went or tried to go a bit further in just completely taking positions out of the equation, because there's some categories, for example, under wide attacker, there's unlocker, and as advanced midfielder, there's creator. I imagine there is some kind of overlap between those two. Is it possible to go further and completely remove any kind of positional sense of these categorizations?
Yeah, so the thing that you call the pie chart, we also call a sunburst chart, which is really just a series of nested pie charts for people who are listening to this and haven't seen this viz. There's an inner circle that's just attackers and defenders, and it's like a 60-40 split for attacking positions and defending ones. There's a circle outside of that has these six kind of positional groups, like your central defenders, your wide defenders, your deep and advanced midfielders, and so on. Those aren't positions. They sound like positions, but they're not. That is, the algorithms didn't know, you know, who was a winger, who was a midfielder, anything like that. These are entirely derived from touch data, from stats. And of course, when you use stats at a high enough level to group players, they are going to fall into kind of broad positional groups. But it was important that it not be based on their, you know, tactical role on the notation of the team sheet. Because you'll frequently have, I used in the piece a soft example of Denzel Dumfries, a wingback who plays higher, more like a winger. That's an obvious case of a guy who, like, we might call a defender, but really plays much more like an attacker. You'll also have much more interesting, I thought, examples like Mark Cucurella when he played for Getafe and Eibar, who are, you know, very stylistically distinctive teams, winds up showing in these player roles as a guy who's grouped with the attacking midfielders, even though he was lining up as a fullback or a wingback for those teams.
That's really interesting. So Cucurella, even at Getafe, was coming out as one of the very attacking roles that you picked up here.
That's right. And so that, I think, is, you know, maybe that's something where just the model is getting wrong, because Getafe is such a weird team, was such a weird team under Bordalas, that it's hard to say what their players are doing. But I think that in itself is useful. Because comparing a fullback on Getafe to a fullback on literally any other team just might not be a very useful comparison.
Well, it's a really interesting example, specifically because I've read a really good piece from a Twitter account called Goal Analysis from last year about Cucurella and about the difference in the role that he played at Getafe versus at Brighton, two teams that could barely be more opposite in many ways. And, you know, it was discussing how you have to either use the data and or, of course, traditional scouting methods to predict the translation between styles and roles within two teams. So I would have expected Cucurella at Getafe to be in a completely different role to Cucurella at Brighton. Now, I don't have all the data to hand, and I dare say you don't have thousands and thousands of player seasons to hand here. But what you're suggesting is actually the data was able to kind of pick out Cucurella's habits, if you will, almost his DNA as a player, and probably map it pretty well, even between the two teams.
I would say yes and no. I think that the data clearly shows that Cucurella's tactical role has changed from a team where fullbacks play one way to a team where fullbacks play another way. And he's also playing, you know, or was playing more left center back as well as wing back. So it captures that role change. It also maybe captures some sort of qualities about the player that are somewhat independent of the tactical role. But it was an open question as I was doing this. Do I want players to always show up, you know, in the same role year to year? Is that a goal that we should have? Or if a player is very clearly doing something different, asked to do something different on the pitch, shouldn't they show up in a different role, right? There's not necessarily an intrinsic role that a player has from one system to the next.
What was the split between players moving clubs or even just season to season playing under different managers? What's the split between like consistent players who hit the same clusters year on year and those who are kind of malleable?
Yeah, so the overall percentages was, I think, 61% of the time a player would wind up in the same one of the 18 roles from season to season. If the player moved to a new team, it would be 46% of the time. Those averages seemed okay to me. Maybe I would have wished that they were higher. On the other hand, like, teams change all the time. A new manager comes in, somebody displaces that player to a different position, or they move to a new team in a new league. And so, yeah, your roles are going to change a lot when you've got 18 of them. But more important to me was when and why are they changing? You know, if I saw a player was bouncing around from season to season, could I identify, you know, what he was doing differently on the pitch, or was it just, you know, noise in the algorithms? And I think that we saw, or I saw digging around in the data for the most part, that there was something explicable generally when a player moved around a lot. And for players who showed up in the same place every year, like Roberto Firmino, for example, or a Busquets or a Neymar, these guys who have clear styles and play the same way every season, they were very consistent.
It's that application of context, isn't it? Of extra knowledge of a situation in being able to understand why things change or why things look the way they are. I guess that's what sets apart individuals, or dare I say it, teams who use data really smartly in recruitment and know exactly how to use it versus those that just have data and look at data.
Yeah, context is always hard.
John, in terms of naming the roles, this really made me think of our glossary pods, Michael. We had great fun basically talking semantics, football semantics, why we use certain words, whether they are the right words to use or not. We bemoaned, as John has in his piece, that the English language is just not as good as some of the other languages, particularly Spanish and Italian and German, in a different sense, in the way that they can construct words to define roles. John, again, I wanted to say I bet you had fun with this, but I think you've even mentioned in the piece, naming the 18 roles was among the hardest bits of this.
Yeah, and I talked to a guy named Mike Imbergio who had done this process before, and he warned me in advance, look, naming these things at the end is the hardest part. One, because it's as far as a lot of people will get, and they'll see a name and they'll think they know what it means and they'll get very angry that it doesn't apply to the players that they think it does. And that's just unavoidable. I think that we just don't have the right words in the English language. And as he pointed out, like, if you give a bunch of veteran scouts a player and ask, hey, describe this guy in two or three words, what his play style is, what his role is, nobody's going to come up with the same word or two to describe that player most of the time. We just don't have preconceived names. But that freed me up a little bit. Because I think there were two ways that you could have approached this. One way that I think people wanted this to go is we start from roles that we think we know what they mean, and I try to kind of define those in data. So we have what we don't have in these roles is a defensive midfield destroyer. That was a type that everybody feels is very clear, and you know, we can think of examples. But it turns out that a lot of the traits that we might ascribe to defensive midfield destroyers, like say the intensity or frequency of their defensive actions, isn't very good at grouping players, because guys who do a lot of defensive actions may also, you know, be a certain type of passer, or they may also be a guy who gets upfield or a guy who sits deep. And so that just wasn't very useful for clustering players into these roles. So I did it a different way. I tried to figure out which stats were really useful at separating players into distinctive groups. where we would have a decent amount of separation. And what I came up with didn't necessarily fit those boxes that we have. We didn't have a defensive midfield destroyer type. And so I tried to use names that were somewhat evocative of what these roles do, but also a little bit corny, a little bit like unorthodox, untraditional. So you get, you know, goofy stuff like aggressor and spreader and, you know, builder. And so you have to ask like, okay, that sounds familiar, but also what does it mean and why? And then you start to look at the data, you start to look at the players who are associated with that role, and you come to a hopefully deeper understanding of what that role means and why those players are grouped together.
We're not going to go through the 18 player roles individually. That's for the readers on site, but just a couple that were maybe less self-explanatory for me. I'd love to know, John, what the major characteristics of a box crasher is.
Yeah, so box crashers, I think, were an advanced midfielder type who were a little bit quirky in that they tended to be heavily involved in midfield and in the box, but not in between. They're not their team's primary playmaker. And so in the same way that box-to-box guys go from the defensive third to the attacking third freely without being super involved in the build-up, they're not the main distributor. The box crasher was kind of the advanced midfield type of that. And some of the examples, I think Foden was an example of a guy who, you know, it's true. If you look at Man City play, he's not the guy who's orchestrating their attacking play. He's not the guy who's always on the ball. But he does get involved in midfield. He drops in and he also scores goals. He gets involved around the box a lot because he's not that primary on-ball creator. And so I think that's what a box crasher is. It's a guy who runs off the ball to create.
Michael, it seems like some people get quite wound up and quite upset when a player that they think should be in a different category isn't, because it doesn't line up with how they see it. For me, those are the most interesting players. Those are the players where, given I understand the methodology that John has gone with for this, those are the players that I'm then most intrigued by. Is it a problem of my eyes? Is it a quirk of the data? Just because something looks like something, it doesn't always mean that it absolutely is that.
Yeah, I think there's probably a sweet spot, isn't there? I think if 100% of the players were exactly where we think or where we expected, it'd be very boring. And if 50% of players were in the wrong categories, you'd say, well, does this work? But yeah, I suppose it's a little bit like what we mentioned earlier with Koeman. He was the interesting one because he was the unexpected one, whereas everyone else was pretty much where you expect. But yeah, there were a couple of interesting ones. I mean, the one that stood out to me was under box-to-box, there's Fabinho, who I think of as being a holding player, I suppose, a builder under these categories. Is there a reason for that, John? Is that because Liverpool kind of press high and therefore he's a bit more all action than a kind of traditional defensive midfielder? Or,
you know, that's exactly the example that I was going to point to. But what you said a second ago, I really liked, because it echoed something that Bill James, who's a famous baseball statistician, likes to say, which is that when you get a new metric or a new model, if 4 out of 5 times it's telling you what you already know, and 1 out of 5 times it's surprising you, like, that's kind of the sweet spot for a metric. Because if it's just telling you what you already know, it's useless, right? Fabinho was that 5th out of 5 where I was certain that he was going to be a builder, which was the type that most holding midfielders in a 4-3-3 tend to be. They stay relatively deep most of the time. They play mostly shorter passes because they've usually got a center mid who's dropping in and doing Thiago stuff to help distribute. And sure enough, for at least three out of the 5 available seasons, Fabinho is classed as a builder in Liverpool's system. One season, of course, he played mostly makeshift center back, and that shows up in the roles. That's helpful to know. And then this past season is when the model tells us that he's a box-to-box player. One nice thing about the model is that it doesn't classify guys hard and fast, yes or no, as this type or that type. It tells us probabilities, certainties. So it can tell us that it thinks that Fabinho is slightly more likely to be a box-to-box type of player, but he's also pretty likely to be a builder still. He's somewhere in between those two things. And I think that we can see in the way that Liverpool plays some hint of why that shift happened. Thiago, I think 2 seasons ago, was playing higher and on the right side. Last season, he was playing on the left. He was dropping into the buildup a lot more. You know, he was playing alongside Fabinho in the buildup a lot more. And Fabinho, as a result, did get forward a little bit off the ball, but also he just wasn't the guy who was kind of receiving the ball first from the center backs and playing those short passes around midfield the way that he had before. And so literally the builder is the guy who builds, right? He does short passes in the buildup. That's his primary job description, not just being the destroyer at the base of the defense. And so when that role was taken away from Fabinho, you see his playstyle role change as well.
Of course, team tactics will play a big part here in the role of a player and how that comes out on the data. John, how do you go about normalizing that, mitigating against that, so that we don't have what is a bit of a classic issue, I think, in football data of really extreme styles of play, in particular, skewing player data a little?
Yeah, you can't very well. And it's an open question to what extent you want to, because a player's tactical role is inextricably bound up with how his team wants to play, with his team's tactics. However, you also don't want every single player who plays for Getafe to be the same type, because Getafe just hits long balls and switches all day long and press like maniacs, and that's all they do. And there's statistically every single player on that team is going to be very different from, you know, any other type. So one thing that I did was I had a team denominator for every single stat. You know, you had the player's rate divided by the team rate, and everything was scaled and so on. You can do certain statistical adjustments, but as we saw in Cucurella's case, that still doesn't solve the problem, if it is a problem, of a fullback on Getafe plays a different role than a fullback on Brighton or another team. And so I tried to adjust for it in the cases where those adjustments didn't make Cucurella look like a normal fullback. I was okay with it because he wasn't playing like a normal fullback.
Another nice way of using the work that you've done is to demonstrate the evolution of individual players. And I wanted to pick on Harry Kane here, who has shown, and we knew this and we have spoken about this on this podcast, Michael, but has shown a fairly remarkable switch in his role and in his output and what he is doing on the football pitch. And it was quite a marked moment, John, in which he did that. Now that comes out in the work that you've done.
Yeah, and I was really happy about that, you know, to see a guy who's got the same essential skill set that he had before, is playing the same team for the same team in the same position, even under the same manager. He played a different role in Mourinho's first season and in his second. We see that evolution, and the model is picking up on that when he became a guy who dropped in more, who became more of a progressive passer, more of a creator. He still obviously scores a lot and gets into the box. He finishes things, but his tactical role has changed at Spurs, and it was nice to see the model picking up on that.
So which are the two roles that he has straddled?
So Charlie Eccleshare wrote a piece about this that just came out, and it talks about he was originally a finisher in Tottenham's system. Now he's a roamer, which is, again, a goofy name for essentially false nine types, strikers who are dropping in a lot, not necessarily as target men, not just dropping to long balls and, you know, playing it back to the feet of some other player, but who are actually creating in midfield and playing forward, direct passes, that kind of thing. And as Charlie said, like, Kane always had the ability to do these things. So his skill set hasn't necessarily changed, but his role has, I think.
That's interesting. I'm sure to have a pretty big role to play this weekend in the Tottenham against Chelsea game. Really stands out on the Premier League fixture list. After we finish here in a couple of minutes, why not head to the View from the Lane podcast, Athletic's Spurs podcast, talking all about that game and much more when it comes to Spurs. The View from the Lane pod, head there after listening to this. A couple more quick ones. John, any other individual players that it would be interesting to bring up? Might I drop in the name Lionel Messi?
You think people are interested in that guy? So a couple things about Messi. Number one, he's remarkably consistent at Barcelona in the way that the model classifies him, which is good. You know, Messi was always Messi at Barcelona. Number two, his role there spanned multiple roles. The model was always a little bit unsure of what to do with this guy, which is appropriate because Messi doesn't play like a lot of other players. Number three, the one player that he does notably play like is Neymar, who has kind of the same distribution of, okay, he's mostly an unlocker, but he's also like partly a creator and a distributor and a box crasher. He's all these things in one. And their profiles look remarkably similar when Messi was at Barcelona and Neymar. I don't think the model goes back to when he was at Barcelona, but ever since he got to PSG, he's been their Messi. And so then when Messi goes to PSG, all of a sudden Messi's role changes. He's now a creator rather than that unlocker, because PSG already has the unlocker. They've already got Neymar, and Messi was willing to drop a little bit deeper and do a little bit more of the midfield passing and let Neymar and Mbappe do what Neymar and Mbappe do.
there's one bit of pretty significant work that I'm going to need you to do off the back of this. And apologies, it might take some time. I don't know how quickly you could build this model. I basically want a quiz off the back of this, Michael. I want a quiz where if I was, let's say, a Spurs fan, I could go on to the Athletic Sporkle equivalent and I could be met with the squad list and I would guess essentially which of the 18 player roles that player, which of those roles he executes. I think that would be both fun and interesting. And those are two things that I search for daily.
Yeah, I'd be up for that. I think this would actually be a really good categorization as well for when, you know, as a journalist, when you're dealing with a squad where there's players you don't really know what they're all about. I mean, I had that a few times in the women's Euros. I saw like the Netherlands, for example. I knew their first 11 very well. I'd know a couple of their subs reasonably well. But there'd be, when you get to the fourth or fifth substitutes, I'd be like, well, is this player a kind of, you know, a wide player who creates, a wide player who scores goals? I think, yeah, if there was just the World Cup squads and we had these little labels next to every player's name, it would make my analysis of, who shall I say, Saudi Arabia much easier than trying to work it out myself.
I'd also, and that is a genuinely serious request, John. It doesn't have to be you who sets it up, but let's make that happen. I'd like to...
No, I love the idea. I would love to do that.
I'd like to throw some weight behind that. And in a much less serious sense, I would like some algorithms, some models to define the following player, more of phrases than roles. Michael, I was thinking, what would be the metrics that we think would most helpfully describe a shithouse? Because I was thinking, and I have thought about this, fouls, yeah, but also fouls earned, mm-hmm. amount that a player has been fouled. I think a shithouse normally draws a lot of fouls. And then I think if we could specify between the types of bookings that they receive, so like percentage of yellow cards that were for dissent, for example, percentage of yellow cards even for a sort of tactical foul, things like that, I think would go quite well into defining shithouse. We could get a really good list of a definitive list of Europe's greatest shithouses. And then
I think you've just written a future column for me, because that would be a hit. Shithousing analytics is brilliant.
I'm on fire today with these ideas. Last one for me, almost the opposite end of the spectrum, the purest luxury players. Now, we've spoken about how a lot of this type have been literally kicked out of the game. Your Raquel Mays don't really exist anymore. But could we do, for example, players who have a very high volume of attacking actions with next to no defensive actions? That for me would be getting towards a luxury player, someone who just really avoids anything when they don't have the ball at their feet. And then I actually think the strongest one here would be percentage of games where this player is substituted off with their team leading. Because that for me is the best. That's how you really know a manager considers a player to be something of a luxury player, is when you're 1-0 up, 15 minutes to go, who's coming off? And you know who I'm thinking of here.
I will point out that according to your previous definition, Lionel Messi is the ultimate luxury player, but he's also the guy who never, ever comes off the pitch. So we've already got a conflict in our data.
That's a huge issue. That's a huge issue. You know who I was thinking about when I thought of percentage of games subbed off when leading was Ozil playing under Mourinho at Real Madrid. I swear he came off every single game around the same time, just trudging off, having done the damage already. Guys, it's been such good fun. Thank you. Firstly, thank you for the work that you've put in on these two pieces, which I've had such fun reading and then thinking about and putting together some questions to ask you. Thank you for answering those questions, for talking me through that excellent work and expanding on it as well. It's been fascinating. So, John, particularly, thanks for joining us from the States.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael, always a pleasure. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
TheAthletic.com/tactics, as you know, is the best place to go for your annual subscription needs. If you're not currently an Athletic subscriber, but you'd like to read these pieces, then head to TheAthletic.com/tactics. I am off to watch Premier League years 2015-16, the glory year for long ball football in the Premier League. But we'll be back again next week, as ever, with a similar type of thing on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Join us then.
The Athletic.